Hello, you're listening to America Unchained. My name is Chris Tidwell, your co-host.
And my name is Richard Dean Winfield.
In the wake of George Floyd's death, we've really been witnessing an uprising, if you will, over the past 2 weeks. And as we know, and especially you know, you've seen decades of protests similar to this. It's nothing new in America. The debates about the systemic injustices carried out by policing institutions in America is a perennial topic. It seems pretty obvious to say in the wake of these protests that the scales of the legal system are unbalanced. And hopefully today we can go into some of the details of that injustice. Officers of the law are able to avoid prosecution by weaponizing their badge. And there's also a plethora of structural inequalities caused by wealth specifically relating to our legal system. Different problems that hopefully we'll be able to tie into some of the contemporary crisis, but also outside of those and bigger new policy. So some of the most problematic things that we can point to are things like incarceration rates in America. I mean, we are number one in the world. We're winning, as Trump would say, in incarceration rates. We're one-fourth of the world's incarcerated, and we spend more money on imprisoning them, and specifically on spending time and money imprisoning them. This also translates to actually getting that populace into the prison. So our police force is largely militarized, and we spend just tons of taxpayer dollars on trying to bolster up a police force that we know is rooted in a history of slave catching and then gets picked up later into war on crime and war on drugs, and it just gets further and further escalated. So, Richard, I'm wondering if you'd be able to talk a little bit about this history and the reasons why it's so prevalent today, specifically in the wake of George Floyd's death.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to first familiarize ourselves with the magnitude of the problem, because obviously the death of George Floyd is not an isolated incident. It's been followed soon after by other incidents, including the shooting by police in Atlanta of a black man. Right. And the statistics are as follows. In the United States, police forces kill approximately 1,100 people per year. And of these, a quarter of the victims are African American. Now, by comparison, the United Kingdom has no more than 3 people killed by police during a year. That means that the rate of police killings in the United States is more than 30 times that of the United Kingdom. The same thing applies to arrest rates. Arrest rates in the United States are 3 times those of the United Kingdom. And the rates of imprisonment in the United States are about 5 times that of the United Kingdom, more than 12 times that of Japan. And these statistics also apply to deaths of people in custody. The figures are much higher in the United States. 12 out of every 100,000 arrests in the United States involve death in custody, compared to 2 out of 100,000 arrests in the United Kingdom. So there's something going on in general with the United States police forces. And of course, it involves a disproportionate toll of victims among African Americans and also other people of color. And one very striking fact, which is raised by Darity and Mullen in their recent important book, From Here to Equality, is that the number of African Americans who were killed by the police each year is greater than the number of fatalities of lynchings in any year in the 20th century.
Wow.
You know, we're facing, in a way, an epidemic of extrajudicial killing, and one that disproportionately affects African Americans. And the same thing applies to imprisonment. You know, we have a mass incarceration in general, but it disproportionately affects people of color in the following way. 33%, or a third, of prisoners in the United States are African American, whereas African Americans make up about 1/8 of our population. Latinos make up 23% of the prisoners in our prisons. Latinos make up 16%. Whites make up 30% of the prisoners in our prisons. And of course, whites make up about 63% of the population. So there are great disparities in all of these figures that indicate what could be considered a kind of racial disadvantage. And we want to try to understand, why is that the case? Is it something that can be considered to be systemic? Or is it something that is due to other factors that would not be regarded as aspects of a systemic racism?
Now, right. Yeah. I mean, it seems like a common conservative argument might be something along the lines of a pull yourself up by the bootstraps. In fact, people of color who are also conservatives have often made that argument, people like Thomas Sowell or even contemporary Candace Owens or something like that. But it's important to note that these problems are structural. I mean, I don't want to cut you off. I know that you're probably getting to that. But in what ways can, I guess, we observe these structures besides just saying there's these statistics of a certain group of people that exist in the prison system? Why is it that it is not just a probability, but an inevitability that statistic takes place?
I mean, I think there is a tendency to try to understand what is going on by speaking about racist attitudes being rampant among police personnel. And there is no doubt that there are plenty of police officers who have racist attitudes. But we have to keep in mind that what counts is not that people have attitudes of one sort or another, but what kind of action they are able to get away with based upon these attitudes. That is, are they allowed to act on their racist attitudes and deprive people of their rights and not be stopped from doing so? Or alternately, if they act on their racist attitudes and violate the rights of people, do they escape accountability? And accountability will have two sides. Accountability will involve punishment for acting against right, and it will also involve liability for paying compensation for the harms that they inflict on other people. Now, I think there are two sides to systemic racism, where we're dealing with something that is not simply a matter of the personal attitudes of individuals and of police in general. One way in which systematic racism operates is that people who do act on racist convictions are not prevented from doing so or are not held accountable for what they do. And that is something that can be based upon the framework of the law, how the law is enforced, and how the courts operate, and how individuals are able to have access to the courts. And these are matters that can operate independently of the individual attitudes of the participants. And I'll explain in a moment what I'm getting at. The other side is that there's a systemic racism when institutions, including the law and the enforcement of law and the judicial dimension whereby laws and the executive branch of government is held to be accountable with regard to the Constitution, the what allows for there to be a systemic racism is that all of these factors, on the one hand, allow racial disadvantage to be sustained, but secondly, intensify and deepen that racial disadvantage. One of the key ways in which that occurs is that the historical oppression of African Americans and of other groups has led to an abiding racial disadvantage that is there despite the lifting of explicit discriminations that are maintained by law, such as Jim Crow legislation. In other words, there is a gap in wealth, a gap in income, a gap in housing, a gap in healthcare, a gap in education. And these gaps are going to affect the opportunities people have, especially when all the factors you need to have access to exercise your freedom, depend upon money. So that, in other words, even if the civil rights movement may have triumphed in removing the legal discriminations that had prevailed until the triumphs of the civil rights movement in the late 60s, the abiding social disadvantage is not going to be overcome when we allow such things as access to healthcare, to housing, to legal services, and to anything else that one might need to function as a citizen, including having an opportunity to participate in politics and run for office, depend upon how much money you have. Because the abiding inequalities in wealth and income, the racial gap in wealth and income, is going to be perpetuating itself so long as all of these opportunities remain dependent upon how much money one has.
Right. And it seems like the determiner of wealth also plays a part in some of the, systemic incentives to have a police department in the United States, which makes us unique. Not a police department, but prisons and probation issues, wherein their profit motive is to try and extort different fees from those who are self-paying, and also try and garner more government funding from trying to make an efficient prison, which oftentimes winds up making the experience of those institutions privatized and not as regulated and worse for the people they're actually trying to help. Could you say a little bit about maybe these for-profit motives that harm the interaction between a prison or a probation system and the people actually going through that?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, you know, our legal system has become more and more infested with fees and the need to make payments and the need to have money in order to make one's way through the legal system. It's become, in a way, a great big toll booth at every stage. And because of that, it ends up systematically disadvantaging African Americans and other people of color. Why? Well, because the history of oppression has left those communities with less income and less wealth than others. And that means that as they go through this toll booth system of our judicial system, of our entire justice system, they become further impoverished, further disadvantaged by the toll it takes. Now, we can see this, for example, in terms of the ability of victims of police brutality to hold the police accountable. We all know that the police have, in many respects, managed to escape being held accountable, both in terms of being punished for crimes against African-American civilians to which they exercise violence to a degree greater than that to which they exercise it on other parts of the population. We know that the police have tended to put up a blue wall of silence and not actually hold one another accountable. We know that local prosecutors work hand in glove with police departments and are very reluctant to act with any genuine independence in attempting to prosecute the police with whom they are working on cases and sharing various kinds of common interests. But on top of that, in order for victims and their families to go to court and get due compensation for the harms that have been inflicted upon them and their family members, they need money. Because in our legal system, you don't have any guarantee of legal representation in civil cases. And of course, in criminal cases, although there is a constitutional guarantee of legal representation in our Sixth Amendment, the way it is carried out puts poor people at a disadvantage because they have to rely upon legal aid attorneys or court-appointed attorneys or a little bit of pro bono work offered by private firms. But by and large, all of these guarantees of representation in criminal cases are less well-funded than what people with money can come up with in hiring private lawyers. And as a result, in criminal cases, individuals find themselves much less able to have a full-fledged defense. I mean, the facts are quite staggering. You know, on average, defendants in criminal cases might be able to see their legal aid attorney for about an hour total. Right. Often they only see them when they go to court. Legal aid attorneys do not have the resources to get experts or do investigations. So what happens? We have plea bargaining, which could be regarded as the highway to mass incarceration. 95% of criminal cases are ended with plea bargaining, where the accused basically succumb to having to admit guilt and pay the price without there being any proper investigation of the facts of the case in court. And they're in that position largely because they don't have the money to get proper legal representation and mount a full-fledged defense. Now, things are much worse in civil cases. And civil cases are just as important as criminal cases and the human being, because civil cases pertain to all the harms that you suffer at the hands of others. And we're not just talking about the police. We're talking about what harm you may suffer with a landlord or a bank or at your job or in terms of sexual harassment, racial discrimination in any sphere, problems regarding family matters, child custody, and so forth. But we have no guarantee of legal representation in civil cases. In 85% of civil cases, individuals have no lawyer. And the results are just disastrous for them. This is one of the things that contributes to homelessness. Because if you do not have a lawyer to defend you against a landlord, you are much more likely to be evicted than if you do.
Mm-hmm. Right. So once again, it seems to be these sort of run-ins with a lack of legal knowledge as well, the inability to actually get the kind of information that you need. And you talked about that somewhat in the transparency problem, and that seems to be a lot related to the fact that these corporations that make money off of the prison system are able to retain that private sphere. And I think this is sort of emblematic of a problem in the difference between a private and public sphere. The But there are still problem carryovers, I guess. There's a transparency problem maybe in the private sector, but also it seems like there's a transparency problem in the public sector when you're trying to make different cases towards getting information from the actual police forces that might have committed these brutalities. There's also obstacles in the way legally as well. Say I want to find a certain amount of footage, for example, that requires a good amount of legal knowledge to be able to actually make an open request to get that kind of information. And those aren't exactly easy. If anybody's gone through those process, the person who oversees it is going to try and skirt your request basically in every way. And also, more importantly, it costs money to do something like that.
Yeah. And of course, police departments have not been required to disclose when police use violence against civilians,
right,
nor to report on past records of misconduct of their police officers. These are kept hidden, but these are matters that the public needs to know about. And right, you know, if we really want to hold the police accountable, we have to have maximum transparency in terms of all of these records, all of these instances of violence perpetrated on civilians. And we know from what information we have that African Americans are subject to acts of violence by police by at least three times as often as white civilians. Mm-hmm. And you know, African American men are killed by police three times as often as white men. And so one could say, if we're thinking about to what degree black lives matter? Well, they obviously matter in this respect three times less than white lives.
Right.
So we need to have the full transparency. And we have to recognize we can't rely on local prosecutors to investigate malpractice on the part of police forces, because they work hand in glove. We really need to have federal investigations of every single incident of police killings of civilians.
Right.
And the other side of it, of course, is we have to ensure that victims and their families are provided legal representation at no cost, so they can fight for their rights in the courts.
Surely. And also, I mean, not just criminal, in particular, civil. And the problem with, I imagine, the disparity in these cases that you're talking about when it comes to criminality or charges that are criminal is the fact that obviously not just, my point is not just in civil cases, it's also in criminal cases where this disparity takes place, is because the white collar criminal can afford a better lawyer and will typically get off. Would you suggest a potential, I know this is something that you suggested for the civil legal cases, but would you suggest a single payer system for criminal cases as well?
I mean, I think we need to have something that, unfortunately, I haven't heard of any other candidate put forward, let alone anyone who is already holding office. And that's the idea of a legal care for all system, which would be modeled on the basis of what Medicare for All does with regard to achieving access to medical care. What would be involved is that you would have a government legal insurance program that would be funded fairly by taxation, that is paid for by those most able to pay, namely, in the case of the United States, the top 1% and perhaps the top 10%. And we can levy both a wealth and income tax that are both highly graduated to cover all of the costs. And basically, in both civil cases or criminal cases, individuals would be able to go to any lawyer of their choice, just as with Medicare for All, you can go to any doctor or medical care facility of your choice. And the services that you would get would be of equal quality with anyone else. They would be fully covered without copays or deductibles by Legal Care for All. And in that respect, we can have a dream team, no matter how much wealth we have. And as long as we don't have something like that, the way in which we provide legal services involves systemic racism. Because there is a income and wealth gap between African Americans and white Americans. And that undermines the access of African Americans to proper quality legal advice and legal counsel. And you can't fight for any of your rights unless you have those resources. So one aspect of overcoming the systemic racism that is compounding the social disadvantage of African Americans and other people of color is to have a legal care for all system and basically ensure that everyone has access to equal quality legal resources in all cases. And keep in mind that one of the main reasons why we have such a prevalence of both sexual harassment and discrimination of various sorts at the workplace is that people do not have the money to pay for lawyers in civil cases and be able to sue for their rights.
Right. And it's a very similar problem as the healthcare problem. They're both radically central. I mean, very, very important parts of interacting with the economy and also interacting with your day-to-day life. But sort of similarly, I see parallels between both the issue of healthcare and the issue of legal care for all. I mean, some of the rallying cries at the protest, I mean, I can't breathe and things like this, they're resonant in bodily concerns, and oftentimes the vocabulary of black bodies are used in this way. But I also see another parallel that's a little bit less about language and more about a proposal for how police departments can change.
Yes.
And that would be primarily to change not just the training, not just the method of interacting with the community, but actually changing the people who are the first responders in general. When people talk today about defunding the police, they primarily cite some sort of defunding of the police force in order to refund social workers or put money back into what you could consider mental health care workers that interact with the community. And so in that way, I don't see these two problems as extremely separate at all. In fact, it would be somewhat similar. Instead of, you know, reinforcing these really militant police forces and that have certain quotas that go in and try and exploit misdemeanors primarily. I mean, a lot of the cases that are actually carried out are going to be misdemeanors or small fines or things that are not this sort of mythologized view of the police, which is that they go in and they take out the bad guys and et cetera. These kind of misdemeanors oftentimes can be tied back to either economic or also healthcare concerns. People will, they steal food oftentimes because they're hungry, or they try and find a place to live. They trespass because they want to sleep somewhere. This problem of police brutality is a really, really sore spot that exemplifies a larger disease of the system.
I mean, one side of looking at the way the police operate in our country is to recognize, first of all, they're not operating in a vacuum, nor are they autonomous. You know, they are operating in a society that could be said to be unusually nasty, brutish, and imposing a life that is particularly short for African Americans and people of color. Because we're failing to provide genuine equal opportunity with regard to health care, both physical and mental and dental and long-term, We're failing to provide genuine equal opportunity with regard to housing, with regard to care for children and elders, with regard to education at all levels, and of course, as we've seen, with regard to legal care. And in that situation, the police are in direct contact, and they're there to hold the lid on this situation of pervasive injustice. So who do they come in contact with? Well, homelessness is a case in point, right? We have people who, in a sense, have nowhere to go, and they are disproportionately African-American and people of color. Because of that heritage of historical discrimination, which even if the Jim Crow legislation and the civil rights movement have eliminated that explicit type of apartheid racism, none of that has eliminated the gap in wealth and income and all the other things that depend upon it in our society. And that tells you who the police are going to be wielding their efforts at keeping the order that is. And for that reason, it's when we talk about, well, replacing police department's personnel with social workers and mental health care workers, another way of looking at this is to provide a situation where we wipe out poverty entirely, we wipe out unemployment, we provide everyone with a reasonable, fair income, and we provide not only an elimination of poverty, but we provide an access to health care, to housing, to education, and to legal representation that no longer depends upon how much wealth you have. And that really is a recipe for the kind of transformation that would allow the police to not be bringing force to bear on questions of let's say, the sides of life to which we all should have access, instead of having the police be, in a sense, exercise of force to keep things in check, instead of being facilitators of our opportunities. And that means that, look, we all know that the police have, thanks to policies that involve a failure to fulfill our social rights and an attempt to keep law and order with wars on crime and wars on drugs, they have had their numbers expanded greatly. They have been armed to the teeth and militarized. And in a sense, curtailing that has to be thought of in conjunction with fulfilling the social rights that we have left in disarray.
Right. I mean, it seems like a relatively simple formula to me, I suppose. I mean, oftentimes you'll hear, why is it that police will commit these violent acts? Well, it's because they're told to go and try and keep peace in places that are the most poverty-stricken, ones that are on their last rope. And if it was just up to the state to try and go to the root of those issues instead of, like you say, keeping the lid on those issues, there would be a lot of change. So some of the other things that are sort of constructs of like police departments that they're taught and they're told to do would be these kind of controlling tactics, but also they're told to participate in, I guess, a community of fellow police officers. And when we talk about how to make the police better, a lot of people bring up reform ideas. And it seems like those have been largely insufficient, given that this is a topic that I can see happening throughout history and then even today. What ways do you think this idea of reform is deficient? Why is it not working, I guess?
Well, I think the primary reason why reform has not worked is that it does not in and of itself in any way remove the racial disadvantage that is both sustained and deepened by the systemic racism that is operative in our provision of healthcare, including mental health care, in our provision of housing, in our provision of employment, in our provision of benefits for retirees and the disabled, in our provision for access to education, and in our provision for legal care. Unless these racial gaps are eliminated, you know, the reform within police departments is not going to be able to accomplish very much, because the police will remain in the position of dealing with this vacuum of public investment, this vacuum in a public engagement, in genuinely providing opportunity to everyone, irrespective of race and the oppressions that they have suffered and the intergenerational poverty that continues to sit in place. Now there are certain reforms that haven't been taken. And I think one issue that one has to keep in mind is the role of the proliferation of guns in America. And we know that the police do not need guns to kill. They can simply put a knee on your throat and kill you. But the police do kill many by shooting people and shooting black men at a rate three times that of the shooting of white men. But they are shooting people and injuring people to a degree that is unparalleled in any developed nation. Now, we could think of fundamentally disarming police on ordinary patrol. I mean, there's no reason for them to be carrying lethal weapons. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you're going to get a response from those who will say, look, the police are not going to be able to do that because they're dealing with a population that is armed to the teeth. So that the police, in a way, could be said to have reason to regard anyone they confront who reaches for their pocket as being someone who's about to pull out a gun. So really, if we want to really be in a position to take away lethal weapons from police in their ordinary operations, which we want to move to, we also have to think of having gun-free public spaces. Now, that does not violate the Second Amendment. Second Amendment doesn't say that we can't restrict where guns can be brought and where they can be used. Keep your gun in your house, keep it in your car locked up and unloaded, take it to firing ranges, take it to animal hunting grounds, but don't take it into public space, because when you do that, you not only are a threat to public safety, you're a threat to democracy. We saw that in Athens recently when, you know, we have demonstrators who come with automatic weapons from, you know, some fascist groups who are there, who knows why. But, you know, how can one exercise one's right to protest when we find ourselves with, you know, armed stormtroopers? We need to keep guns out of public spaces. And then, on the other hand, we need to disarm police departments of lethal weapons in their ordinary duties. I mean, there will be circumstances when police will need to deal with armed violators, but those should be the exception. And there shouldn't be this kind of ordinary militarization so that the police operates as if they are an occupying army. Instead, they should be there in a way to be guardians of our real opportunities.
Right. I mean, and it's important to point out that, I mean, George Zimmerman wasn't a policeman. The man who killed Trayvon Martin.
I mean, we have to keep in mind in connection to Zimmerman and also to Ahmaud Arbery, right, that one could say that lynching is alive and well. It's primarily occurring in terms of police killings, mm-hmm, of unarmed civilians and in particular unarmed blacks, and getting away with it. But we also have civilians who are going out and killing with impunity. And what allows them to kill with impunity, relatively speaking, are laws that have been adopted in many states that are operating in a way like the black codes that were instituted after Reconstruction was withdrawn to essentially allow the white population to lord over the black population. And I'm talking about a law such as the one that Zimmerman could avail himself of, namely of laws where you can stand your ground and get away with shooting someone to death, or laws that allow you to make civilian arrests and operate like an armed vigilante who can terrorize groups, African-Americans, immigrants coming across the border, right? We see this happening. And these laws are instruments of really, you could say, systemic racism, because they allow individuals to get away, civilians to get away, with violating the rights of people who end up being predominantly people of color. And that's one side of it. We also, of course, see it in terms of many other laws that, in the way they're presented, are race neutral, such as laws regarding drug enforcement. We have, obviously, as we all know, different penalties for different kind of drugs, much lower penalties for marijuana possession than for crack or heroin possession. Well, these are laws that in their application involve a systemic racism, because they impose a burden that is specifically directed at poorer communities, and African Americans in particular. And they deepen their disadvantage, because what happens when you go to prison or are accused of a crime? First of all, if you have a job, you no longer have it. You can no longer support your dependents. You lose whatever housing you have. This may affect your custody of your children. And in our nation, as it stands, your work possibilities in the future are tremendously undermined, because this record is going to haunt you for the rest of your life. You know, we need to eliminate the criminalization of personal drug use and drug possession, not just of marijuana, but of any drugs, and treat them, if at all is a problem, as a medical problem. And with something like Medicare for All, ensure that everyone has access to the kind of counseling they need. The fact that we don't have equal access to drug counseling, to alcohol counseling, means that those people who can't afford to get private services are going to be subject to all, you know, the effects of drug addiction, alcohol addiction, and how it impacts upon one's behavior and undermines one's life and sets one in contact with the police. Well, that is a situation which is another side of systemic racism, because it directs its harm disproportionately at African Americans and people of color. Why? Because there is this racial gap in wealth and income. And when these services can only be had if you have the money to buy them, then there is a racist deprivation of those services. And that then takes you back to the police, who for poor people are their mental health warders. Mm-hmm. Not giving treatment, but applying force to contain the pathological behavior that is properly a medical problem.
We talk a lot about the different ways that people deal with this kind of incarceration. And one of the most, I guess, one of the primary things you deal with when you're charged with something is cash bail. That's a prevention of your freedom, despite your guilt or not, keeping somebody in prison. Can you outline how that contributes to this crisis of legal care and also systemic racism?
I mean, as we discussed, you know, we are really the great exception among modern legal systems in allowing there to be cash bail, because it is so obviously a way of allowing poor people to be subject to pre-trial punishment simply because they lack the money to pay for their bail, their cash bail. And there's no excuse for that. I mean, if people are really a threat to the community and there's a worry that they're going to destroy evidence and engage in witness tampering, then you don't let them go on bail. And you don't allow those people who have money to be freed when they are going to do things that one has a reasonable judgment to presume that something like that will happen. And then in addition to that, you know, we have this gigantic for-profit bail industry dominated by billion-dollar companies. They have revenues of $14 billion a year. We pay an additional $14 billion to house the people who are in jail. The people who have to pay, who pay bail and avoid being stuck in jail, they're people who then often have to borrow that money, and they have to pay a 10% fee to the bail company, and then they may have to pay additional interest on what they might borrow further. And that then becomes a further burden, and then they can be thrown back in jail if they fail to pay these things. And that pertains to all of the fees that have proliferated in our legal system, that both people have to pay in going through the court processes. To get a DNA test, you'll have to pay for it. To be subject to any kind of electronic monitoring, you will have to pay for that. You might even have to pay for a jury trial or for the size of the jury. And there are even fees for your legal aid lawyers. And all of these things deepen the disadvantage of the poor. And because the poor are disproportionately people who are African-American and of color, this is another application of systemic racism, where our justice system is disproportionately harming African-Americans and deepening their oppression.
And deepening the pockets of the people who yeah. make money off of this, which yeah. it's important to note allows them to then spend money on lobbying campaigns to try and keep yeah. these laws intact yeah. and in place.
And one thing to keep in mind, we're not just talking about a deepening of economic deprivation. We're also speaking about a political deprivation. Because when you are in jail, and particularly when you are in prison, you're not really able to exercise your political freedom. And in particular, in the United States, we do something which is not done in many other countries. We take away the voting rights of prisoners. And not only do we take them away while they're in prison, we often take them away and keep them, shall we say, taken away after people get out of prison. And since African Americans are imprisoned at a disproportionate rate, mass incarceration is also a matter of racial vote suppression, because it is disproportionately taking away the vote from African Americans.
And it's just a compounding issue. It's yeah. something that helps provide the people who don't want policy again, yeah. to be alleviated off these people. And it provides also for those people to be reelected on the ballot box, not just money, like yeah. you're saying, not just money. It's also political as well.
So and keep in mind that we have for-profit prisons proliferating in this country, for-profit probation services. Their business model is to have as many people incarcerated as possible and to keep them in incarceration or on probation as long as possible, and to provide them with as cheap services as possible. Mm-hmm. And the large companies that dominate these respective industries spend a lot of dollars in making political campaign contributions to ensure that our legislators make laws that do things like impose longer terms of imprisonment for crimes, three strike laws, mandatory sentencing. All of these things have been promoted through political contributions coming from this private prison and probation industry.
Right. And I mean, it doesn't seem to be any kind of accident that there is that direct connection. I mean, there's a wonderful video on YouTube that's an exemplar of the problems with the American Legislative Exchange Council, better known as ALEC, wherein local governments will adopt a template policy, typically racist template policy, that helps ensure that these for-profit prisons, for-profit probations, and the ilk maintain that kind of power on a local level.
I want to make one remark to sort of just put in perspective the general situation regarding systemic racism and how one views it. There are two prevalent views that are held by many who do not believe that there is systemic racism. And one is that we can essentially overcome racial disadvantage by simply enforcing the laws that were enacted during the time when the civil rights movement had its triumphs, and that as long as we enforce those laws and do things like make police accountable, that racial disadvantage will be eliminated. Well, as Martin Luther King knew, you know, racial disadvantage is not eliminated by simply overcoming Jim Crow legislation and by ensuring that the police do not, let's say, use violence disproportionately on African Americans. We still have to deal with the social disadvantage, and that is not removed by that. On the other hand, there's another view, which is that given that there is this pervasive racial disadvantage that infects all aspects of life, that infects not just wealth and income, but healthcare, housing, education, the legal system, that this means that we regard it as being something that rests upon a pervasive racism in the personal attitudes of individuals. So one says that, in a sense, the persistence of racial disadvantage is to be explained by the fact that everyone is a racist, except for African Americans, or that large sectors of the population are all racist. But I think you have to recognize that systemic racism does not at all depend upon the attitudes of individuals. It has to do with the fact that we allow our society to operate in a way where opportunities are accessible based upon how much wealth and income you have. And when there is a wealth and income gap that has resulted from open racial discrimination, then racial disadvantage is perpetuated and deepened, even if individuals act without any kind of direct, open racist animus. And it's important to recognize that if we're going to think seriously about the remedies that are needed.
Yeah, well, that sounds exactly right, and I think it's a good way to go out. So thanks so much. I think this was a really topical episode, and also a really good review of problems that are ingrained in America. So, till next week.
Okay, thank you. And I think we have to recognize that the violence perpetrated by police against African Americans is the tip of the iceberg of racial injustice that continues to pervade our society due to a systemic racism. And we need to further investigate this and think through the remedies.